Welcome to our second session in anesthesia. Our track today is for powerful techniques using local and regional anesthetics with Dr. Harvey, and special thanks to Pfizer for sponsoring this track.
Thank you, Dr. Grabo. We were talking during the break there about an interesting case that Dr. Grabo had where she had excellent pain management in a dog with pulmonary carcinoma with Remedil for quite a few months, but at one particular point the dog was very debilitated, had some other problems going on, and she finally determined by getting a more thorough history from the owner that the owner, very well intentioned, as owners will, but very well intentioned, they were not only giving the medication she prescribed, but they were stacking on top of it some aspirin. Okay? So once she extracted that information from them and got them to stop giving the aspirin, she continued on the Remedil and the dog did great for quite a few months. Yeah. So these medications can help tremendously. Again, thank you all for being here. Beautiful day in Denver, and I appreciate very much your interest in being here, and I do encourage you, as you did in the last hour, to please contribute your thoughts and jokes and observations and criticisms as we go along and make it much more interesting for all of us, really. So we're going to talk about some of my favorite medications right now, and that's the local anesthetics, some of the oldest drugs that we've had available for us. We find increasing applications that allow us to take good care of our patients and avoid a lot of problems and really make our job much more successful and much more economical than it was in the past. Cocaine was the first local anesthetic that was used. First reported in 1984 and was used as a topical anesthetic. Obviously, there's great abuse potential, but cocaine is actually still used as a topical anesthetic by ear, nose, and throat specialists. Halstead described peripheral nerve block using cocaine, and then described spinal anesthesia also using cocaine. In the more modern era, we had procaine available in 1905 and lidocaine in 1943, and it does continue to serve as a very, very valuable anesthetic and indeed the standard of comparison of local anesthetics. These local anesthetics act by blocking conduction. They prevent the increase in the permeability of nerve membranes to sodium ions. They slow the rate of depolarization thereby, so the threshold potential is not reached and the action potential is not propagated along the nerve. There's no alteration in the resting membrane potential or the threshold potential. So we won't spend too much time talking about mechanisms of action. But they do block conduction, preventing that increase in sodium ions and preventing that impulse from propagating along the nerve in this kind of fashion here. Jumps from node of Ranvier to the next until it reaches this block. The local anesthetics provide a locally active reversible block. The autonomic manifestations are a decrease in autonomic function. Somatic sensory block results in anesthesia, and a somatic motor block results in paralysis. So what we're aiming for is a sensory block, and we get the others as a side effect occasionally. Structurally, these are either amides or esters. The best example of the amide is lidocaine, and procaine serves as an example of an ester. It's the type of linkage between the lipophilic portion and the hydrophilic portion of the molecule. In order of function, when a local anesthetic is applied, pain is the easiest thing to block. As the concentration of drug around a nerve increases, we then block cold, and then warmth, and then touch, and then deep pressure, and then finally motor function. As an individual recovers from the local block, it goes in the opposite direction. So when we go to the dentist and we get our gum blocked for a dental procedure, the easiest thing that's blocked is the pain sensation, and then we have a block to the sensation of temperature change, and finally touch, and finally deep pressure, and finally motor to where we can't get our tongue out of the way. Okay, and then as it comes back, you're going to regain the ability to drink, and then you're going to regain after that the ability to tell whether it's either hot or cold that you're drinking, and finally sensation will come back, and hopefully by then the pain of the procedure is passed. If we give too much local anesthetic, we have the potential for toxicity, and the first toxicity that we'll see is an increase in electrical activity in the brain. We have a CNS irritability that's manifest by tremors and convulsions if it goes too high. If we're giving a lidocaine CRI, for instance, if we give too much local anesthetic systemically, if we give too much lidocaine to control cardiac arrhythmias, we may see an animal that's a little twitchy at first. And if we keep giving more, that can progress to seizures. But it's very quickly responsive to a reduction in dose. Lidocaine is cleared quickly. Can go to a lower dose if we need to maintain the medication for either pain management, prokinetic effect on the gut, or to maintain control of cardiac arrhythmias. A lower dose can often be maintained. We also have the potential for cardiac depression at higher and higher doses of local anesthetics. And in order to avoid toxicity, I have a rough guideline when we're using either 2% lidocaine or 0.5% bupivacaine. As a rough guideline, if we keep the volume of drug under 0.2 mils per kilogram, we will avoid that toxicity. And it does vary some from patient to patient. And I have seen tremors and seizures in animals due to local anesthetic toxicity. But again, they're very, very amenable to treatment. But as a rough guideline, I'll keep the total volume under 0.2 mils per kilogram. Yes, sir. Question is a very good one. Is that related to the route of administration? And I try to say no. I'll act of it as if it is not. And yet if I inject a tissue, and particularly if the local anesthetic has a vasoconstrictor present to delay absorption, that's not going to reach plasma concentration really fast. Okay. On the other hand, if I'm giving my local anesthetic intravenously, either as a loading dose or as a CRI, that's going to reach plasma concentration very quickly. As a measure of safety, I'm going to use that same number, whether it's a local infiltration or a systemic route. A table of a variety of toxic effects that can occur with local anesthetics, and I've thrown this up. It's a little hard to read, I'm sorry. But it includes symptoms of lack of tissue perfusion, tissue sloughing and gangrene, and those are all related to those local anesthetics that have the addition of a vasoconstrictor. Okay, it's not the local anesthetic itself, it's the vasoconstrictor that's been added to it. Our principles of pain management, as we've said again and again, are preemptive analgesia, balanced analgesia, and a willingness to dose to effect. So that preemptive means give your opioid analgesics as a pre-med instead of just as a post-op analgesic. It also means dose early, dose before the last dose wears off, okay, rather than waiting for the animal to become painful. Rather than dosing morphine or hydromorphone every 4 to 6 hours, I'd rather dose it every 2 to 4 hours at a lower dose. If we use lower doses more often, we'll use a total lower dose over a 24-hour period of time. In human patients that self-medicate, they're in a hospital with a PCA, patient-controlled analgesia. They get very tiny doses just when pain is starting to be an issue. When they recognize, oh, I'm starting to feel a little discomfort, I'll go ahead and push the button. They're timeouts to prevent people from over-medicating themselves. But people who use the PCA device have a lower total dose requirement than those who only receive their analgesic when they really, really hurt and call for the nurse. Okay? So preemptive analgesia, it reduces dose and makes it more effective. Balanced analgesia is the multimodal combined analgesic strategies, drugs of different classes, like opioids, local anesthetics, alpha-2s, dissociatives. Okay? Dose to effect, give until it helps, like the United Way says. Okay? Yes, ma'am. Great. Question is, when do I decide to do a CRI versus a systemic opiate or something? Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about that as we go on. Ask me that again if it's not adequately addressed, because we have a fair amount on CRIs, specifically as they relate to local anesthetics, but also the addition of other drugs to it. Preemptive analgesia, again, then dose early before the knife hits the flesh. If we could give it, we'd dose before the bus hits the bone, or Buick hits the bone. Dose before the patient hurts. Balanced analgesia. Local anesthetics are such a key component of this, such a key component, because they block that transmission of the pain impulse from the periphery to the central nervous system. And then they block transmission along the central nervous system if we've given an epidural with a local anesthetic. And again, willingness to dose to effect. Let's consider some of the specific local anesthetics. Again, lidocaine is the reference drug. Procaine is another name for Novocaine. A lot of dentists have used. Mepivacaine or carbacaine is used a lot in horses. Bupivacaine or marcaine is a local anesthetic that I use most extensively in my anesthetic practice. Long-lasting, but a relatively slow onset. Benzocaine is a drug that used to be used quite a bit. It has good absorption from mucous membranes. It used to be used extensively to facilitate endotracheal intubation. It's available in a spray, and it was used to spray the throat to prevent spasm of the larynx, and it should not be used in dogs or cats. I still see bottles of it around occasionally, and it causes potentially fatal methemoglobin formation. You can have measurable levels of methemoglobin in a dog following a single spray of benzocaine. And a single spray is designed for a human adult, not for a dog, and certainly not for a cat. Proparacaine or ophthane is a very nicely absorbed local anesthetic for mucous membranes, sold for topical ophthalmic use. And I like it when I'm going to put a nasal tube in a dog or a cat or another species. Very rapidly absorbed. Finally, articaine is a local anesthetic that's sold in a preparation called septocaine. It's sold for dental use by the Septodont Corporation. So articaine is a local anesthetic. It's very lipid-soluble. It diffuses very nicely. So my dentist introduced me to it. He said, you've got to try this in your patients because it's hard to have a failed nerve block because it's so lipid-soluble. It spreads even through cortical bone. Yes, I've heard of prilocaine. Yep. Yes. So his comment is that prilocaine was recommended by a periodontist and has been very useful in his practice. In your question. Articaine for oral ulcers would be fine. It's temporary relief. Anybody ever added bicarbonate to lidocaine? Yeah, good. Thank you. Anybody ever had an injection of lidocaine without bicarbonate? Stings like hell, doesn't it? It hurts worse than the procedure quite often. The addition of bicarbonate does not remove all of the sting of lidocaine, but it helps tremendously to do so. And the proportions that are used are usually 1:4 to 1:10 bicarbonate to lidocaine, and it's mixed just before the time of injection. If you mix it and set it on the shelf, it's going to precipitate. So it's added just before the time of injection. It does not work to add it to bupivacaine or marcaine because it'll salt out immediately. But it's a wonderful thing to do to your patients that are awake and about to receive a local injection, a local anesthetic injection. Really helps. You say amen, brother? Thank you. Yeah, I had a few little moles removed to the dermatologist, actually as a resident at the hospital, and he didn't know any better and didn't add any bicarb, and I didn't feel like messing with him to let him know, and man, I wish I had. I can still remember it. Let's talk about the application of these local anesthetics. Local infiltration is just the easiest thing in the world to do in an operative setting. Say you've removed a tumor, you have an operative site, just infiltrate the margins before you close. You can do it preoperatively if you recognize where you're going to cut. For instance, in anticipation of doing do a line block before you do a C-section in a bitch that's anesthetized, and you can maintain her on a much lower level of inhaled anesthetic, a much more lower level of injectable anesthetic, and the puppies or kittens or whatever come out much more alert because you've done that local block, that line block, in advance of the procedure. A splash block really should be considered more of an infiltrative block. It's not really just splashing it in a wound. That's not good absorption. Topical applications, again, laryngeal, ophthalmic, intranasal, as we've discussed. The spinal or epidural anesthesia or analgesia that we'll talk about a little bit more and we've discussed in the last hour. Regional blockade or specific nerve blocks, including intravenous regional anesthesia or a Beer block. It was described by Dr. Auguste Beer and has been used extensively in hand surgery in people and is also used extensively for claw amputation in cattle. The technique is to place a catheter in a peripheral vein and then wrap the limb with an Eschmark bandage from distal to proximal, a nice tight exsanguinating bandage, and then put a light tourniquet on above there. Remove the Eschmark bandage, and then that catheter that's in the vessel already is used to instill a very dilute solution of local anesthetic that's distributed through the vascular system and blocked by that tourniquet, and it desensitizes the whole limb. It's used a lot for hand surgery in people, and again for claw amputation in cattle. If you make application of that, please know what you're doing first and think about it, because in dogs in particular, I wouldn't do it in cats because there's susceptibility to systemic toxicity. But in a patient the size of a dog, once you release that tourniquet, you get a flush of a tremendous volume of local anesthetic to the patient that can be quite toxic. Okay, it's a very valuable technique. In a cow, they're so big, you're not going to get them toxic with that amount of lidocaine. And it really, really helps with claw amputations in cattle. Very inexpensive and easy technique. But we have used it also in dogs with great success. Certainly, lidocaine is used as an antiarrhythmic, the first drug to reach for with ventricular arrhythmias. And then more recently and very, very powerfully as an analgesic and anesthetic contributor as a constant rate infusion. We make a lot of uses of bupivacaine or marcaine. In this particular dog, we're doing a maxillary nerve block in anticipation of removal of an epulis. To perform the maxillary block, and we do a lab to teach these blocks in a program that we've done rather extensively with the support of Pfizer. We have a program that's called Partners in Pain Management, and we'll go into a practice and bring in at least one veterinarian and at least one technician from one of several practices, good practices in the area, and work with them in a cadaver lab to teach these procedures. And the idea is that in any sort of group learning exercise, we have much greater success in implementing those new skills if more than one individual has been trained. And particularly if two people, those partners in pain management, go back to their practice, they'll encourage one another. You know, when you get back home from a meeting and you're all fired up about something you've heard, probably about what somebody else has said instead of what I've said, but you're excited about something and you're interested in trying it or applying it, and everybody else is back there saying, yeah, I bet you had a great time in Denver. And get back to work, you know, or let's go on with the day. And you kind of get discouraged. Maybe you don't implement those new things. But if the veterinarian and the technician both come back to that practice, they'll say, yeah, here's one. Here's a patient we can do that. So that's what we've tried to do with these labs, these cadaver labs. And we can go through the diagrams here. And these blocks in general are pretty easy to do, but you'll have a much greater success if you can practice in some cadavers through some fashion. What we want to show in this first slide is the maxillary nerve block, and it will desensitize the upper arcade of teeth all the way around to the midline. And the way I perform the maxillary nerve block is to come off the ventral margin of the zygomatic arch. See if I can see it here, kind of looking at the side. You can see a round structure there. It's the hub of the needle. You're coming off the ventral margin of the zygomatic arch in the average-sized dog about a half centimeter lateral to the lateral canthus of the eye, and drop that needle in a rostral and ventral angle toward the opposite premolar. And you're actually going to land in something you thought you could forget, the pterygopalatine fossa. Okay. So you're going to land in the pterygopalatine fossa and you'll block the maxillary nerve as it enters the skull there. It will desensitize the entire upper arcade of teeth. If you're working in the rostral portion of the maxilla, a lot of veterinary dentists will prefer to block the nerve from this site, the infraorbital foramen. They'll take the needle, you can palpate that infraorbital foramen up underneath the lip, you can feel that foramen and slip the tip of the needle into that foramen, advance it a short distance, and then put your finger over here so you occlude the exit and inject that drug under some pressure, and it will course along that canal and to where it desensitizes the nerves that are supplying these teeth. I feel I can get a better block of the entire upper arcade from doing the maxillary block back here. Some people prefer to do the block at this level at the infraorbital foramen. If you just get the nerve as it exits the foramen, you're obviously not going to desensitize these teeth, which will desensitize the gum and the upper lip. Okay. The dose is 0.1 to 1 mL of bupivacaine or septocaine. The alternative technique is that block at the infraorbital foramen, which is described here. How many people doing these blocks? Okay, how many of you are doing it the maxillary? How many doing the infraorbital? More popular, a little less scary. I think a key to success is to advance that needle a short distance, put some pressure over it for your injection. If you don't advance it into the foramen, if you don't put pressure on there, you're not going to do as good a job of blocking the nerves to those caudal teeth. Move on to the mandibular nerve. We can block the entire lower jaw by blocking the mandibular nerve as it enters the ramus of the mandible, right about at the transition between the vertical and horizontal portion. That foramen is on the inside or lingual aspect of the mandible, right at the transition. It's about halfway across the course of the mandible right here. You can often feel that foramen, mandibular foramen, from inside the mouth. Reach way back there. A lot of people will perform this block from inside the mouth. Sometimes I'll do that in a big dog. We can also perform this block from outside the mouth. You come up underneath the jaw, and importantly, on the inside of the jaw. Okay, you can feel the notch right here, this contour. You can't feel this process because of attachment of the muscles, but you feel this notch right here. Advance your needle right along the bone, about halfway across the course of the mandible, and deposit 0.1 to 1 mil of either bupivacaine or septocaine. An alternative here is to block the mental foramen at the end of the mandible. A good way to find it, sometimes you can palpate, but if you follow the contour, the posterior contour of the lower canine, you'll follow that contour about halfway across the course of the bone. It will be the site to make your injection. And these are really, really valuable blocks for extraction. We do the mandibular or maxillary block for jaw resections for bony tumors. It tremendously decreases the amount of inhalant necessary and really provides nice analgesia in a setting where a systemic opiate is certainly limited in its ability to do the job alone. Again, the epidural anesthesia, epidural analgesia, we have to talk about this when talking about local anesthetics, just as we discussed it in the last hour. Tremendous decrease in their stress response to the patient if we include a local anesthetic, because the spinal cord is no longer being hammered by that barrage of information. Okay. Landmarks are easy to palpate in most dogs unless they're obese. The landmarks are the rostral margin of the wings of the ilium, the point most far forward that you can feel. It's probably right about here, not at the very rostral tip because it's way out here. But the rostral dorsal portion of the wings of the ilium, draw a line across those, and then feel the dorsal spinous processes of the vertebra. And if you draw a line right across between the wings of the ilium, you'll intersect with the dorsal spinous process of L7, and just behind that you'll find that lumbosacral depression. Well, that's our target. We're going to aim our needle forward, aim it approximately toward the patient's knees, in the angle of their knees. You'll feel a series of pops as you go through the interspinous ligament, skin and dorsal spinous ligament, interspinous ligament. And then once you're in that space, you should have a loss of resistance when you push the plunger. It should slide down nice and easy and not bounce back at you. Some people will take the stylet out of a spinal needle and put a drop of saline or a drop of local anesthetic in there. Technique is called a hanging drop. How many people have done that before? Maybe in a lab, yeah. Works really well in horses and in humans and in some dogs, especially if you have internal recumbency. We do some of our blocks in lateral recumbency. Some animals don't have a lot of negative pressure in there, but it's one way of verifying that we're in the space. Also, as we make our injection of drug, it's a very easy injection. Okay, there's not a lot of resistance to injection because it's in that potential space. We should always aspirate to make sure the tip of the needle is not in a vertebral sinus. Okay, provides powerful and sustained analgesia, again for typically 18 to 24 hours, effective from the tip of the tail to the tip of the nose. We've used epidural morphine for thoracotomies, for total ear canal ablations, for rostral mandibulectomy. I've not yet used it for the next dog in the cage in front of that one. Okay. Technically very easy, extremely cost-effective, even using Duramorph, but even more cost-effective if we're using the parenteral morphing. Yes, sir? Oh, very good question. The common question is, have we had much trouble with interference with ventilation by blocking intercostal or diaphragmatic action? And no, we've not. In part because these days we're using a lower dose with our local anesthetics. And that's been a real advantage of these techniques that are based largely on the use of morphine or another opiate. We get a lot of our analgesia from the opiate, and then we augment it with the local anesthetic. Years and years ago, Dr. Lum, Colorado State, was one of the people that kept the technique alive for epidural injections in dogs. And he did so as an alternative to general anesthesia, typically for C-sections, or in animals whose lungs were trashed and weren't good anesthetic candidates. So we do an epidural technique in those old days using just local anesthetics. And using just local anesthetics, you need a much higher dose. Once the opioids are combined, we can cut our local anesthetic dose in half, have much less rostral spread, much less interference with the motor function of ventilation, if you will. As a person example, when my daughter was born, she was a big girl. She weighed 9 pounds, 13 ounces. And my wife had a spinal injection with fentanyl and lidocaine for the labor and delivery, the catheter placed and had those for labor and delivery. Within 1 hour of delivery of the baby, she was able to get up and walk by herself to the bathroom. And in the old days, when the spinal and epidural technique were used for labor and delivery, and certainly for C-sections, it would provide such a profound block that the lower part of the body reportedly would feel numb, would feel dead. And a lot of women really, really didn't like that because they felt like they didn't have anything. The lower part of the body was totally gone. And now by combining opioid and a lower dose of local anesthetic, we have good pain control, but there's some sensation. At least, yeah, my legs are still there and I can still wiggle my toes. So that's a very good question. At these lower doses, we should not have interference with ventilation. We'll move on to a very beneficial application of local anesthetic, and this is for feline declaws. So we talked about this rather extensively in yesterday's discussion of feline anesthesia and analgesia. I think all of us kind of hate doing declaws. It takes off 10 healthy digits or sometimes more if they're polydactyl, but in a cat, and hopefully we're doing it for some better reason than just to preserve the furniture. But there are people who just can't keep their cats unless they're declawed. And when we do a declaw, we have an obligation and an opportunity to provide good pain relief. And one of the most powerful parts of that is to just do the little local block at the level of the carpus with a little bit of bupivacaine or bupivacaine and lidocaine mixed. Everybody doing that? Anybody? Yeah, good, good. So lots of advocates for that. It's such a inexpensive and powerful part of the technique. So very, very important to keep in mind that you never want to do that block with anything that contains a vasoconstrictor. Okay. Never use anything that contains a vasoconstrictor for a peripheral block. Okay. Typically use 0.1 to 0.3 mils of bupivacaine at each of three sites, blocking the palmar aspect of the medial and lateral carpus and the dorsal aspect of the medial carpus. We get branches of the radial, median, and ulnar nerve. Brachial plexus nerve block is useful for procedures distal to the elbow. The block is performed at the level of the shoulder, but really takes its beneficial effect from the level of the elbow and distal. So it's great for carpal arthrodesis, for surgical procedures on the feet, for distal, ulnar, and radial fractures. Again, tremendously reduces the dose needed of our other drugs, and the dogs wake up much, much better. It is among the more blind procedures that we perform. It takes a pretty long needle in the average dog. The needle is advanced at the level of the shoulder, between the shoulder and the rib cage, in a fairly blind fashion. And it is an area where we have a lot of nerve trunks and a lot of vessels as well. So two of the keys to success are to aspirate at each site before you make an injection, and to withdraw the needle slightly, aspirate again, and inject a very small volume. Withdraw, aspirate, inject a small volume, withdraw, aspirate, inject. Follow that series at one or two sites. I don't like to make a pincushion and go in 8 or 10 sites in there, but I'll allow on distribution of the drug to spread it out. But I'll aspirate at each site to make sure we don't give an inadvertent intravenous injection, and I'll give a small volume because the tip of that needle may be inside a nerve sheath. And there have been a few patients that have been reported to have prolonged radial nerve paralysis after this technique when too large a volume was injected at any one site. If the tip of that needle is inside a nerve sheath and causes some ischemic damage to that nerve, they may drop their foot for a couple of weeks. Yes, sir? Yeah. Question is, would I advocate using a nerve stimulator for this block? I think it's a great application if you have one. There are nerve stimulators that can be attached to an exploring needle that has a electrode clip somewhere on the dog's body, and then the other clip goes onto the hub of the needle, and the needle is shrouded with Teflon or another electrical insulator except for the tip. So wherever the tip of that nerve is, tip of that needle is, whenever you fire that electrical nerve stimulator, if it's right next to the nerve, you'll see that leg jump or contract. Okay, so that's an exploring peripheral nerve stimulator. It's a great technique. It allows your block to be much, much more specific. It's a piece of equipment that most practices don't have, but it's great to specifically know where you're giving that drug, have a much greater level of success. So that's a great technique. Stifle block is the easiest joint in the body to block. It's the largest joint in the body. And we use it typically when we're going to perform any surgical procedure on the knee. We evaluated the efficacy of a stifle block in comparison with epidural morphine and local anesthetic in comparison with systemic hydromorphone in a large series of dogs. And we found that an intra-articular stifle block with bupivacaine was almost as effective as an epidural injection. And one of the techniques is described here where the dog is in lateral recumbency under anesthesia and the knee is clipped and prepped. And the needle is advanced at an oblique angle, either medial or lateral to the patellar tendon, aiming for a spot between the femoral condyles with the objective of not scratching the articular cartilage, of course. Aspirate, sometimes you'll get joint fluid out, sometimes you won't, but you should not see blood. So aspirate and then make your injection. The volume that I'll use of bupivacaine, 1.5%, is 2 mils per kilogram, 0.2 mils per kilogram. And I'll inject pre-op and post-op, and I think both are very valuable. It's important to do both, and very, very inexpensive. Use the same volume. Yes, same volume for both. And I talked to you earlier about keeping the total volume under about 0.2 mils per kilogram, and you can spread it out like that over that period of time. It'll be fine. Exactly. Same technique as doing a joint tap. There's and I think it'll show a leg that's hung also, so it's exactly like doing a joint tap. In fact, we'll do it as a part of that procedure sometime. Occasionally, we'll like to see what the joint fluid looks like before taking an animal into surgery. So you draw some fluid off, change the syringe, and give them the injection. I'm deviating from that now, yeah, because I'm giving one pre-op and the other one considerably later post-op. That's enough to distend the joint also. And when you make that injection, you'll see there are three pouches that communicate well enough for the drug to spread around. And as you make that injection, you'll see some swelling of the knee, and also typically you'll see the heart rate and blood pressure go up in the dog. They may start huffing and puffing under anesthesia, of course, when you do this. But it's very stimulating to the dog. That's a good question. Is there enough time interval there with using bupivacaine to have onset of the drug? And in my shop, there certainly is, because I'm in a teaching hospital. There certainly is. I might worry about the limited duration at only 6 hours, sometimes. But that's a very good question. If you're moving right ahead, as you typically are, then that's a good time to do a combination, at least for your pre-op, of lidocaine and bupivacaine. Yeah, so I'll step away from my academic shoes and wish I were in your shoes at those times. Well, here's the dog's leg that's hung ready to go in surgery, so his foot's in the ceiling and his body's down on the table. So we don't even need to touch the animal's knee to do this. Don't need to put gloves on because you're not going to touch him. You just rotate the foot back and forth. You can see the tibial crest. You can see the patellar tendon right there. So aim between the femoral condyles and the job's done. Also, some people will add morphine. Anybody doing it with morphine also? Two people are. Yeah. There are opiate receptors in the joint, and that works great also. Yes, sir. So if I can hear you right, and the air condition's a little bit loud. Yeah. I told you not to. Yeah. There have been studies that demonstrate the presence of opiate receptors in the joint, and there have been studies that provide evidence-based medicine that it is efficacious. So I don't typically do it because I get a great result with the intra-articular local anesthetic and systemic opiate. So I just never have gotten in the habit of doing it. Lots of ways to make soup. Yes, sir. That's a good question. If we're doing a cruciate procedure, am I combining that with an epidural? Well, in our TPLO series, our TPLO patients in a big research study, we compared those two along with third comparison group with systemic hydromorphone. And we found that the epidurals were most efficacious. The intra-articular was almost as good, and then the systemic hydromorphone by itself was not as good. So then would I combine all three even? Certainly sometimes I'll give a systemic opiate along with an epidural, or give a systemic opiate certainly if I'm going to do the intra-articular injection. Sometimes we'll give a systemic opiate at a low dose, an epidural because that animal is set up for more pain for whatever reason, and then also inject the knee. If we have an animal that's very sensitive, very, very safe procedure to inject that knee. So sometimes I will take advantage of these as complementary procedures, just as we'll add complementary classes of analgesics. Just as we provide balanced analgesia with an opiate, local anesthetic, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, sometimes an alpha-2. By combining these strategies, as you suggest, we're able to use lower and lower doses of each one. Yes? Yes, the question is, when we use a combination of lidocaine and bupivacaine, do we use equal volumes? And yes, in most cases. Most every time when I want to use a combined lidocaine for its rapid onset and bupivacaine for its long duration, I will typically use equal volumes, regardless of the application. This is one of the best applications for use of local anesthetic intraoperatively, and this is an amputation. It's amputation at the distal femur, probably for a tumor, maybe for some other procedure, I don't know. But whenever we approach the leg for the amputation, during the course of surgical dissection, every time we encounter a structure that looks like a nerve, we'll have a sterile syringe with lidocaine plus bupivacaine, and this is a good time to have them both. We insert that needle into that structure, aspirate, because it might be a vessel. If it is, tie it off, cut it, and move on. If it's a nerve, we inject it with the local anesthetic, proceed with our dissection for a few minutes, and then come back and transect that nerve. As a result of having first blocked that nerve with that injection of local anesthetic, we prevent that barrage of information from hammering the spinal cord when that nerve is transected. Doing so prevents the development of central sensitization and windup in that patient to a tremendous extent. Prevents the development in human patients of chronic pain syndromes like phantom limb pain. Okay? We don't know if our patients get phantom limb pain. You know, most dogs and cats do well as amputees. You know, if you need to convince your client that an amputation is in order, it's nice even to have a tripod around to show them, because so many dogs and cats do so well with an amputation. But some of them just don't. And it's not necessarily the very heavy animals or those that have evidence of degenerative joint disease in the other limbs. Some animals don't do well, and I have to wonder if maybe some of them don't have some central sensitization and something like phantom limb pain. That foot hurts that they no longer have. I have a friend who is a double amputee from World War II. He lost both his distal legs, his distal limbs. He lost both legs, the level of the knee, from frostbite in the Battle of the Bulge. And he has phantom limb pain in one of his ankles. Hasn't had that ankle in over a half a century. But that ankle sometimes will hurt him so bad that he's ashen and shaken, and we have to take him to the emergency room. And I think we can prevent that type of syndrome from developing in our patient if we block these nerves before we transect them. Yes, sir. Comment back here. With? Serapin? Okay. Okay. Same kind of objective? I believe it's been used to tie up substance P in pain management. I'm familiar with that preparation. But I know the local anesthetics work, and I think they're less expensive. And I think they're very efficacious. We have another application intraoperatively here, and that's the intercostal nerve block. The diagram shows this block being done preoperatively from the outside of the dog. So the needle is inserted between the ribs, walking off the most proximal portion of the rib as close to the spine as you can find it through the layers of muscle and fat. Find the rib, set the needle down on the rib, and then walk it off the posterior border of the rib, right where the vessels and the nerve lie. So just ventral to the rib, aspirate, and then make an injection with small volume, say 0.1 to 0.5 cc's of local anesthetic, maybe two spaces behind the proposed thoracotomy and three in front. And that intercostal nerve block will diminish the amount of general anesthesia that's needed during the procedure and will improve the animal's ability to breathe postoperatively because they're no longer splinting their thorax. Sometimes we can't find the ribs too easily in our animals, and then we'll block them intraoperatively. And intraoperatively, you can see a white line coming up along the top of each rib, alongside each rib, and then block them during the procedure, but we lose the preemptive advantage. We can also do an interpleural block. In this case, a through-the-needle catheter is being placed in the pleural space. Okay, and then that's used to infiltrate local anesthetic. In this case, in this cat, postoperatively, we have bilateral chest tubes. We're going to use those tubes once the thorax is negative. We're going to place a dilute solution of local anesthetic and saline in there. And if possible, we'll lie the cat in a position so that the effective surgical side is ventral and lateral. Okay? So we bathe the trough of the ribs coming off the spine with a dilute solution of local anesthetic, and it anesthetizes that side of the thorax. And it may interfere with intercostal function on that side, but the net effect is an improvement in ventilation because the animal feels like breathing. They're no longer splinting that thorax as a result of pain. Yeah, good question. How much can we dilute the lidocaine or bupivacaine without losing its effectiveness? In a cat like this, I'd probably make a solution of about 2 cc's, maybe 1 cc each of lidocaine and bupivacaine, and dilute it to maybe 6 cc's total. Yes, if I could hear you, and again, I couldn't hear you too well, but what's the potential benefit for things like pancreatitis, GDV, and other abdominal pain? It does have beneficial effect, and so does the constant rate infusion. And intraperitoneal application of local anesthetics has been demonstrated in a study of postoperative spay to provide analgesic benefit as well. Systemic lidocaine by a constant rate infusion is a very nice technique for pancreatitis pain. Okay. One of the advances we have for local anesthetics is one of these pumps. This pump, this particular one, is powered hydrostatically. It's like a latex balloon. You fill it up under pressure, and inside it has a cavity for local anesthetic. And it drives that local anesthetic under pressure through a tiny orifice, and that controls the flow rate. And then you place a catheter that's fenestrated in a surgical wound to provide a slow delivery of local anesthetic in a surgical site. And here's another one. It's a soaker catheter or a diffusion catheter. I think the Myla catheter company sells it as their diffusion catheter. And Myla makes a lot of good catheters, and they'll make things for you on a custom order as well. Soaker catheter is the trade name for another company. I'm sorry, I don't remember which one. Here's an interesting application of local anesthetics that you may or may not be aware of. AMLA stands for eutectic mixture of local anesthetics. It's a combination of lidocaine and prilocaine in an emollient cream. And it's usually applied to children, and then a tegaderm dressing is placed before a catheter is placed through their skin or for needle punctures. And children are still afraid of needles, okay? But if a child has to go in the hospital for repeated medical procedures, this sort of thing can really relieve their discomfort and their fear of going in the hospital. If it's not working well in this type of application, it's probably because they're not giving it enough time. It takes about 30 minutes at least, and an hour is much better for absorption of that local anesthetic through the skin. In this particular cat, we used the AMLA cream. This cat belonged to one of our residents, and it had a history of some type of problem under anesthesia at a previous institution, and we needed to trim the margin of the ear, and she wanted us to give this a try, and we did, put an occlusive dressing, and came back about 60 or 90 minutes later. And in order to demonstrate that it worked, we just drove a needle through the cat's ear, and he didn't care at all. So we were able to trim the margin of that ear off without anything other than this AMLA cream. Yes. AMLA cream penetrates the skin better than a lidocaine cream. This brings up for discussion the lidoderm patches. How many people have used lidoderm patches? Anybody? Veterinary or human application? I've tried them myself. A number of people have tried them for a variety of more internal things. I tried it for a fractured rib, actually, and was grossly underwhelmed by its contribution. But I have used them on my father-in-law for shingles pain, and they can help quite a bit. They're indicated for that. That's one of the indications. They have been used in a variety of veterinary applications, the lidoderm patches, with mixed success. Getting on to the constant rate infusions, again, something we're really positive about. Lidocaine does have that prokinetic action. It keeps the guts moving, very valuable in GI surgery. Provides contribution with regard to analgesia as well as anesthesia, reducing the inhalant requirement substantially in patients that are at risk of hypotension. provides a nice anti-inflammatory contribution by blocking those reactive oxygen species. Extremely cost-effective. Again, the recipe here, loading dose of 1 or 2 milligrams per kilogram for those of you who were not here earlier. We try to achieve a therapeutic rate somewhere generally 50 to 100 micrograms per kilogram per minute. Usually the therapeutic range that's recommended to control ventricular arrhythmias is 30 to 80 micrograms per kilogram per minute, so it's roughly the same ballpark. Delivered either by a syringe pump, a fluid pump of some other type, or a controlled drip. And the easy setup method is, again, described here. Adding 68 cc's of 2% lidocaine to a liter bag of fluids. Administered at 1 cc per pound per hour to achieve 50 mics per kilogram per minute. Those of you who'd like to get this recipe and many others, I'd recommend that you go to a wonderful web resource that we use and we use extensively with our students, and that's the Veterinary Anesthesia Support Group. And Dr. Stein has put this website up over a number of years and provides some really excellent information in terms of analgesic and anesthetic suggestions, a lot of good history. He's contributed quite nicely to our science and our art of veterinary anesthesia. So it's, you can find it by searching for Veterinary Anesthesia Support Group or VASG. We use that extensively with our students. It's a great teaching tool and has some macros for calculating infusion rates and doses of a variety of medications. How many people have used that VASG before? Yeah, it's great. Question, a very good question. Thank you. Am I using this lidocaine in cats? And I am not, no. Thank you for bringing that up. I should have mentioned it earlier. The lidocaine infusion can be analgesic in cats, but it approaches the toxic dose. And in order to get a MAC reduction, you've already hit the toxic dose in cats. So with rare exceptions, I will only use it in dogs. I think I have an example coming up of a cat in which I'd use it. Other CRI combinations, we've mentioned adding ketamine in the form of the MLK or morphine lidocaine ketamine CRI. We use a lot of fentanyl or fentanyl lidocaine CRIs also on a syringe pump. And again, depending on where you buy your fentanyl, it can either be very inexpensive or very expensive. Case studies. Some of you saw this kitty before. Ran into a fan belt problem. Used to have a lot more of these before engine compartments were shielded as well as they are now. So certainly a multimodal approach. This kitty would do well with an epidural. I think he deserves a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, and I think he'd like a systemic opiate as well. He'd like some ketamine also. Ketamine augments mu-opiate receptor binding and in itself increases analgesia from the opiates at very low doses. And the ketamine has been used in sub-psychogenic doses to help with pain control. And indeed, in some cocktails for human cancer patients, ketamine is used at sub-psychogenic doses. Mary, I'm about out of time, right? 5 minutes, okay. You saw this guy if you were here in the last lecture? This one? Okay. Any other thoughts or comments? Yes? Yes, questions about retrobulbar injection for enucleations. The Peterson nerve block is used a lot in cattle. It's a retrobulbar injection. It's not used as much in small animal patients because it's easy to hit a reflection of the dura and get a potentially lethal subarachnoid injection. What we do instead is a four-quadrant block. Okay, four different spots coming up against the bony orbit in four places to make our injection. If we use a fair volume, then it distends the tissue in an awkward and problematic fashion for the surgery. So I think this is a good way to use, a good place to use local anesthetic with a vasoconstrictor. And the septocaine, again, is a nice choice in that regard. Yes? Yeah. I bet you're patient waiting for it to take effect, too. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. If you're trying with the Emla cream or the generic formulation of it that's not Emla, if you're not satisfied, you're probably not waiting long enough or you're not using a bioocclusive dressing. You can use a Tegaderm dressing over it, but you can also use some Saran Wrap. And if it's not working well enough, you're probably not waiting long enough. Other comments? Once again, thank you so much for your involvement. Thank you.